Accession number 16750, Reel 3.
This is Peter Thorne, Reel 2.
Right.
The Sabre?
Yes, the Super Sabre, in fact.
The F-100.
The F-100. The Sabre, incidentally, the F-86, was a very good aeroplane indeed. Mm. And while one's thinking of Sabre-like things, there's absolutely no doubt about it. With the lack of aeronautical knowledge of the transonic that was available at and just after the end of the war, the Americans were very lucky indeed on the Sabre that when they got to the stage, it originally started off as a swept wing, a non-swept wing aeroplane designed with some other name. They got
Fury, wasn't it?
I believe it was. I believe it might have been. In fact, I'm quite certain it was, because the FJ-3 Fury, which was the naval variant, which one flew at Patuxent, was a direct variant. Now, the thing about it is that with the German information they got about swept wings, which apparently we didn't have, or if we did have, we didn't make very good early use of, they went ahead, and there's no doubt about it, even the F-86A was a very good aeroplane. And by the time you got to the F-86D, well, there you were. Well, I think, apart from that knowledge, there was a good deal of luck in it, because the wing was good, which is absolutely basic. If you haven't got a good wing, it doesn't matter what the rest of the aeroplane's like, but they got the tail in the right position. I'm not sure that they really knew that they put it there because they thought that was a good place to put it. I don't think there was any really good basic technical reason why they did, but it was in the right position. And in actual fact, skipping historically rather, the Hunter was a much more amenable aircraft than the Swift in the same region, having had the same signs of the same difficulties, largely because the wing was a little better, but the tail was in a much better position. That was just because he put it there, because I'm quite sure he thought it looked pretty. As far as the Swift was concerned, of course, it had the tail in just the wrong position, whereas it was in the middle of the mark cone and working in dirty air all the time. And there we were. However, we are now on to the F-100, which we were asked to go and fly, and it had originally suffered some terrible difficulties, the F-100, with, I think, roll yaw coupling, which was an almost unknown phenomenon in those particular days. Anyway, they had trouble with it. They put it into service early. This is the United States Air Force. Put it into service early in a condition which we would never have put it into service. And it had great trouble with longitudinal handling, particularly at high indicated airspeed, over-controlling, and great difficulty. And from the over-controlling, people got into difficulties. They've got a big air force. They'd killed 20 fighter pilots before they took that out of service. Completely re-engineered the longitudinal control system and put it back in. And when they put it back in, they told Boscombe that if they had any peripatetic pilots, they would be only too happy to let them fly it on an exchange basis. So I went across there with a pilot from REE and a non-test pilot from CFE, from the tactical evaluation organization. And we went over there to fly this aeroplane, and it was startlingly good. There's absolutely no doubt about it. It had a wonderful cockpit. Everything worked properly. You knew exactly what you were doing. Mark 1.4, it was limited to, it would do Mark 1.4. I'd already flown the Lightning, so I knew that what proper supersonic aeroplanes would do, but the P1A was limited to 1.2. It was seamless, it really was, from that particular point of view. And at the end of the test program, it was a very, very good, I loved it dearly, but I very nearly planted myself, because thinking, well, they've got it right, I know what's been wrong with it, and I was screeching across the desert doing a well over 500 knots and possibly over 600, I can't remember exactly how much, and I thought, well, they've got it right, we'll just do a PIO, a pilot-induced oscillation, just to make sure that they've got it right. They hadn't got it all that right. And in actual fact, it instantly set up a fugoid oscillation of, thank God, not...
Well, you just put the stick forward and back quickly.
You push it.
Yeah.
You just push it. You don't let go of it, but you just push it. And that gives the impetus, and it's a pilot-induced oscillation, and basically speaking, in the best forms of stability, of course, it does a deadbeat return. But at least you want it to get back to trim condition as soon as possible. It didn't. It diverged, and then, thank God, I was possibly too terrified, because you don't like breaking other people's aeroplanes, and I think one knew instinctively the best thing to do was to let it alone. So, but it went on neutral stability for quite some time, and then it got back to the trim state again. But it frightened me, and when we did the post, it was a verbal post, well, report for the whole program that we'd been doing, of which I think I did five flights. The REE chap did four flights, and the CFE chap did two flights. When we gave them the lot, we mentioned this, and they looked at each other a little bit sideways. And I'm quite sure that they didn't know it, because they're very, very open and honest about these kind of things. If they'd found it out, they would have said so. But the aeroplane didn't go into service quite as early. It had been in service already, but they put a restriction on flying it. And it had a bob weight in the longitudinal circuit. And bob weights in control circuits at high indicated airspeeds are always a little bit dodgy, because, of course, they can get G-forces operating on them independently from the force operating on the main control. And there we are.
Of course, it had already killed one visiting RAF pilot, hadn't it, who went to try it out?
Yes, they had.
I can't remember his name.
Nor can I, and until you mentioned it, I'd forgotten it.
Mm.
Of course, when you're at the end of a four-year tour as senior pilot in a place like ANAE, you do get very arrogant. And the mere fact that somebody else has done something wrong was almost certainly because he hadn't got it right. It's an unlovely human attribute, but there we are.
Those American naval aircraft, the Cougar, for instance,
yes.
were they interesting?
They were lovely. The Cougar was a superb aeroplane.
It looked good.
I think Grumman generally got it right with their aeroplanes until very, very late on. And we have friends in the test community who are Grumman test pilots, senior ones. Corky Meyer is a particular name to conjure with in that area, and a very close friend of one of my friends. They were lovely, they really were. It just is, they'd got it absolutely right, and of course they were carrier aeroplanes, and they would stay absolutely rigidly on the path you put them down on the approach. Everything else about the handling was good. A very good aeroplane indeed. And loved it. And the only aeroplane that wasn't as good an aeroplane, in my view, was at least in the approach configuration, an excellent aeroplane, was the Hawker Seahawk, which, of course, designed for the same kind of purposes and did the same kind of job. And there we were. It was absolutely straight wing, of course, whereas this Markham Cougar had 15 degrees of sweep or something of that sort. They've got it absolutely right. I love that. And the FJ3 Fury, of course, was just an Arenda engine Sabre, but the Arenda was a damn good engine. It was a very pokey aeroplane. It was another very good aeroplane. It was an altogether super detachment, no doubt about it, except for the slight underpants trouble with the F-100 I've already mentioned. And the Cougar, the third of the aeroplanes one flew there, that really was tricky. It was
the Cutlass, you mean?
I beg your pardon, the Cutlass. Yes, absolutely right. It was huge. If you stood on the ground and reached up, and I'm just 6 feet, so we'll make it, what, nine? 9 feet up, you could just touch the drag link on the nose wheel undercarriage. It was colossal, and tailless and strange. And its form of engine control was I managed to get it to go supersonic, largely by ignorance more than any other way, but it was a very, very awkward aeroplane. I wrote, we didn't take, as I said, I'd flown the three new types of aircraft in the same day, and although we'd studied the pilot's notes on the Patuxent pilot's notes on the previous day, you know, we didn't take knee pads, and it didn't have a voice recorder in or anything like that. It was just a get-to-know kind of exchange posting. But I couldn't really describe how strange the thing felt. It had an extremely high energy absorbent undercarriage, which I tested on landing because it was a long way off the ground, and you thought, well, right, this is okay, we've got this approach pretty well swayed off, and the approach was good. I just about time I should start getting the nose up when crump and you went. It didn't disturb it at all. There we were. So that was a thoroughly good visit to the United States from the flying point of view.
So really, I mean, what I'm interested in knowing now, you briefly referred to it, the political situation of what came to be called the super priority fighters.
Yes.
There was a great harvest of prototypes in the early 50s at Farnborough, and nothing was actually going into production. And I think it was the Churchill government that brought the super priority label into existence. What impact did it have on? Do you want to move out of the light?
No, it doesn't worry me at all. No, unless it worries you.
No, I'm in the shadow.
No, my squinting at you, I meant. No, I think it was a bit less bang bang steering than that, but a bit more fundamental in concept. The great thing about it was at that particular time, I've already roughly referred to it on the basis that in the F-100, for instance, they didn't have they were lucky to get not the F-100, the F-86. They were lucky to get post-war German research influence, and I don't think we either got as much, or if we got it, I don't know what we did, it buried it at Farnborough or something of that sort. But in the immediate post-war years, there wasn't a great deal theoretically known about flying in the transonic region. And of course aeroplanes then would fly up to about 0.8, tunnels just about 0.8, a bit below probably, tunnels stopped at about 0.85, and supersonic tunnels didn't start until around about 1.15 or thereabouts. So you had that hiatus in the middle, and that had to be filled with test flying. And when you've got a situation where, after the war, as you know, enormous numbers of people out of the service, great destabilizations all around, very little funding indeed from the point of view of research. And you've just got arrangements where a little bit of research funding went in, certainly to supermarines, and a certain amount, I suspect, into hawkers, although I'm not certain. But hawkers, of course, were always very determined and might have put their own funding into it and hoped to get it back from the Ministry of Supply afterwards. That's when you've got the 1052 kind of progression, because the progression towards the Hunter was the same as the progression towards the Swift. The Supermarine 510 did have swept wings and a swept tail, but the Hawker 1052 didn't. It first had swept wings and a straight tail. Then there was another 1067, I believe, with a swept wing and a swept tail. And then
1081.
Precisely. Yeah. That was another in the step. There were three of them. Mm. I'd forgotten that one.
Well,
but
I think it was a 1067, wasn't it?
It could have been.
Yeah.
Whatever it was, there were three steps before they got there. And with the Swift, there were two, And I think that was a reasonable decision because, you see, they'd already got the attacker in naval service, and the attacker was perhaps a bit more of a muscular aeroplane than the Seahawk. So perhaps they thought, and the system thought, that that was it. They all started on that particular business, and I think what actually generated the acceleration in the whole process was, of course, the Korean War. Because, first of all, you got a situation. We didn't really take any air part in the Korean War worthy of mention from the contribution point of view. There were 17 RAF pilots on exchange with the Royal Australian Air Force on Meteor 8s and on F-86 with the stuff. The carriers were there with Fireflies and Sea Furies, I fancy. In fact, certainly. But I'm talking really about the RAF, since it was both the Hunter and the Swift who were really preeminent in the research drive to the second generation of jet aeroplanes. When the Korean War came, quite obviously there was the MiG-15, and very shortly to be the MiG-17, and the Sabre could initially cope with them. We didn't have anything that could get anywhere near. Well, first of all, that was something which became very publicly known, because it upset, well, the Air Force would have known it, of course, but it upset us, as you can well imagine. We wanted something. We knew that the second generation jets were progressing ever so gently, and that people were doing a lot of work, not only on what ultimately became the Hunter and the Swift, but also on naval variants in both areas. And de Havillands were doing all sorts of work of various kinds, and of course there was an enormous amount of naval work going on at Supermarines. In fact, I think it was one of the elements that the overloading of their tech office, which was a bit significant in the slowdown of development of the Swift after the 510. There we are. So I think that was the situation. I've not been able to make a direct link, and you are much more informed on the historical basis of this than I am, without a doubt, Rodney. But reading what I've read in the backgrounds of this, yes, there was a super priority program. Yes, it did cut down, effectively speaking, the twiddly bits of research and development that were going on at that time, and focused it. I'm reasonably sure that what would have started it off in that particular case was the reaction from the Korean War, because the reasons I've just given you on that one, we had obviously to have something, and there of course we had a great big force in what was then BAFO, British Air Force of Occupation, just about to turn into the Second Tactical Air Force, equipped with Vampires and Venoms. And I mean, that just wouldn't do. So something of a scandal. And in 1950, in fact, for the first time, the Prime Minister, in a defence statement, having effectively speaking said, we are going to be very careful about spending money on research on aeroplanes and on aeroplane development, because we don't want to waste it. We don't know what's ahead of us in the transonic era. And that was said not long after the end of the war. It was only in 1950 that the first statement made was that our rearmament plans are going to develop more quickly. So I imagine that was round about the time that the super priority thing came in. I think that was the background of it. Certainly, as far as I can evaluate, that was it.
Now, when the Swift came to you, what was it like as an aeroplane?
Well, we just have to go three steps backwards, of course, to the fact that the Swift was, basically speaking, the Mark IV aeroplane. And the Supermarine 510 was a prototype runner-in, followed by the Supermarine 535, which didn't have a tailwheel, and one or two other tweaks. And then, after those two run-in aeroplanes, prototypal aeroplanes really, you got the three marks of Swift before you got the Mark IV. But they were always intended to be, effectively speaking, run-in service-worthy, mark you, but run-in aeroplanes to the Mark IV, which would reach the standard which OR-228, if I remember rightly, was demanding. A pretty demanding standard it was, too. Well, I didn't fly the 510. It came to Boscombe in 1949 and again in 1950. It had the kind of test program where something went wrong, it had to go back to the firm, and then it came back again. I've quoted my writing to Nigel what the A-Squadron pilots of the day in 1950 thought about it, and in general terms, what they were expecting to find, which was really nasty handling from the swept wing element, i.e. Wing dropping, serious wing dropping at the stall, and wing dropping on landing, particularly in crosswinds. That was there, but not devastatingly there. Most of the rest of the stuff was okay, except that they noted that the longitudinal control on the aircraft was very poor. The limiting Mach number was 0.93, incidentally. They noted it then, in 1950. And then we didn't get another sniff of the aeroplane until there was a...
Is this the 535 you're still talking about?
No, I'm still talking about 510.
Oh,
we didn't. Yes.
Yeah. Mm.
We didn't get another sniff of the aeroplane until the 535 came for an air brake assessment in 1952. Now, it was... The 535 was, quite frankly, an amiable enough aeroplane. I flew the 535 a couple of times on this air brake assessment. The air brake worked perfectly well, but the 535 was limited as well to just over, probably about 0.93. I haven't got the test report available of it, I'm afraid. But the air brake, in actual fact... which was the first 35 degrees of the 55 degree movement of flap travel. The flaps were big and the air brake worked very well. Very little trim change until you got to 0.9, and after that there was a trim change, and of course with the Swift, which would go much faster, that trim change became very naughty later on and very awkward. But that was the 535, and in actual fact the first time we got another sniff, if I can just look at my notes for a minute. I don't know whether you want to... Yes, will you? Would you mind? On this Swift question that you've just asked me, I think it would save a lot of time and effort if I just read the paragraph of the work I'm doing for Nigel Walpole on what I hope will be his Swift book, which says... The conventions of the period as they concern firms' aircraft trials and the A&AEE were that the firm had the prerogative to decide when they should send their aircraft for evaluation to Boscombe Down and when or if they should invite an A&AEE test team to visit them. On their side, Boscombe Down could request that an aircraft be made available but could not insist. A&AEE had their first taste of the Swift on 8th November 1952, when Squadron Leader C.G. Clark, the senior test pilot of A Squadron, was invited to do two flights in the first production Mark 1, WK-194. He reported that the aircraft was prone to pre-stall instability, tightening in turns, severe wing drop at the stall, and intense aileron buzz at high indicated airspeed. This was disturbing enough, but was compounded the following month when the two USAF test pilots tasked with evaluating British fighters for the US offshore procurement scheme, flew the Swift. General Al Boyd criticized uncontrollable wing drop and directional instability on landing. Inadequate longitudinal control at high indicated Mach number, well, lateral control also, quote, left much to be desired, unquote, and unsatisfactory air brakes. He concluded that the Mark 1 Swift was unsatisfactory and in some cases, some circumstances, unsafe, quite pleasant to fly in some conditions, but requiring a long period of development before it could be considered a satisfactory fighter. Colonel Richard Johnson concurred, adding that he wondered if Supermarine were really ready to put the aircraft into production. All this was bad news for the firm. There had already been an increased production order in mid-1952. And that was just about all we knew about Swifts at that particular time. I think General Boyd went a little bit over the top on his wing drop and directional instability at landing, but in fact that was really the state of the aircraft as a squadron knew at the end of 1952. And we didn't actually get at the aeroplane again. Well, there was another hiatus period, really, while the coronation flypast practice was going on. We took part in that. The A squadron test pilots didn't. I didn't actually take part in that myself, but other A squadron pilots did. But of course, that wasn't test flying as such, and we didn't get hold of the aircraft again until some time when, if you stop that, I'll be able to look and find out. Yes, well, I think the next significant part about the Swift was that we tried very hard to get a proper preview trial done in A squadron. At the time, in 1953, when work was going on, as I mentioned earlier, on the coronation flypast, which was really blocking test work at the firm. But nevertheless, we couldn't get it done. Ministry of Supply kept on replying. We asked them formally from ANAE on at least three occasions. On each occasion they said, no, the firm know what the trouble is and they are putting it right, so you can't have it because effectively they don't want you to have it, which, as I pointed out earlier, was one of the difficulties of the day. And there was one heartwarming interlude in 1953 when Mike Lithgow set a new world speed record at 737.7 miles an hour in the prototype Swift 4, WK198. But this was very shortly followed by an Air Council decision that number 56 squadron should be equipped with Swifts and flying by the end of 1953. And this was where the brown stuff really started to hit the fan. And I'd like to stop there if we can. And we... Well, after the decision that the Swift had to be in service and flying on 56 squadron by the end of 1953, of course, the next thing that was needed was a CA release, otherwise the aircraft couldn't be flown by the service. And that meant that the CA release had to be done in short order. So the first test aeroplane to do the CA release got to Boscombe, I think in November, possibly late October, and in actual fact, it the trial wasn't... It really got stopped before it started, because and my colleague Ned Lewis got into an uncontrollable stall on the aircraft, and the aircraft was destroyed, and he was killed. Now, we went on from there, but we didn't get another Swift. We got two at the same time, just before the turn of the year, immediately before the turn of the year, and we started test flying immediately afterwards in January 1954. But the difficulty there was that directly we started flying the aeroplane seriously, which we hadn't done when Ned was killed. He was killed on one of the first test pilots test flights. We found that the aircraft was so far from being operationally acceptable, as could have been told from Nobby Clark's original half preview trial, if you like, earlier on in 1952, that it just wasn't any good. We didn't want to release it. We got a directive that it had to be released, and that was all there was to it. We had to give a release based on the minimum safety status. Don't need to go into them on what they were at the moment, tediously, but the important point about it is that it was quite clear that whatever we did, they were going to get that aeroplane into service. We used to say in A squadron, they're going to get that damn thing into service, or they're going to get it up at Waterbeach by the time of the air estimates of 1954 if they have to take the wings off and pull it up by road, purely and simply because they'd made statements about it politically in 1952 and quite strong statements in 1953. So it went into service then at Waterbeach on what we rather sceptically call the fast taxiing release. It couldn't operate in any way as a fighter and was in actual fact completely unsatisfactory so to do. Because it was thought that it might be put right, we had to continue testing it, and we did do, on the Mark I, and found that in actual fact nothing could be done, or nothing was done, to make it acceptable. Then when the Mark II came in, we had really serious trouble, because the Mark II had a changed wing plan form because of the embodiment of two extra guns, and the forward stretch of the main plane towards the route end to cover up the feed to those two guns. This changed the aerodynamic characteristics of the aircraft considerably, and the pitch-up that was one of the great troubles of the Mark I was exacerbated.